Broadcast of the Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series is made possible in part by ProLiance Energy. ProLiance, adding power to energy. Information is at ProLiance.com.
The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's speaker is NCAA President and former University of Washington President Mark Emmert. Emmert has a history of educational leadership and success and wants to see student athletes remain in school.
Prior to joining the NCAA, Dr. Emmert had been president of the University of Washington since 2004. He led the university to its standing as second among all public and private institutions in research funding with $1 billion in grants and contracts annually. He is also credited with expanding the university's reach through satellite campuses and enhancing its presence in China. Previously, he was chancellor at Louisiana State University. He's also held appointments at the University of Connecticut, Montana State University, and the University of Colorado. A Washington native, Dr. Emmert earned his bachelor's degree in political science from the University of Washington and a master's degree and Ph.D. in public administration from Syracuse. He was a J.W. Fulbright Administrative Fellow and has written extensively on higher education and public administration. I know we're all looking forward to hearing his remarks. Would you please join me in welcoming Mark Emmert?
Well, first of all, thank you for this invitation. When I first learned that I was going to have an opportunity to speak to you, I was delighted. I'm still learning the Indianapolis community, but obviously the Economics Club is one of those institutions that's for 35 years, is that what you said? For 35 years now provided the community with an opportunity to hear people speak and to get together and think about the issues of the day. And so for me to get to participate in that is a great pleasure. I think the agenda refers to my speech as the business of intercollegiate athletics or something like that. And that's really what I want to talk about. But I wanted to begin by making just a couple of observations that I've always found pretty fascinating. You know, the first is that as a graduate student, I always was interested in behavior, organized behavior. I did a lot of work in organizational behavior and wondered about a lot of things that one found in societies, and I tended to look for things that were ubiquitous across the whole planet. Wherever you found people, what kinds of organizational structures did they put together and how did they behave inside those structures? And it turns out there's only a handful of things that are truly ubiquitous, that you find everywhere. And one of them, interestingly enough, is sport. That wherever you go, anywhere on the planet, there's different kinds of games. We're tending now to move towards a handful of common games. But wherever there was people, wherever there were people, there was always some kind of competition that was going on that involved physical activity and physical prowess. And it was something that humans developed in a very, very natural way. There's something very viscerally appealing to the nature of athletic competition, whether it's as a competitor or as an observer, as a fan in the stands. We like these games. And whatever it is about them, they inspire enormous passion, huge amount of interest. That's driven a very, very rapidly growing business around the globe, not just in the United States. It has, in fact, inspired, you know, nations to come together and compete, and sometimes in ways that have been really, really useful for fostering international relations. It's easy to forget that in our lifetime, well, the lifetime of most all of us in this room, we didn't have relationships at all with China. And how many of you remember ping-pong diplomacy? Right? It wasn't an accident that the first things that we exchanged with China was athletic competition, because it was a sort of neutral way to get to know each other a little bit better around this, you know, silly thing, this game of ping-pong. But in fact, it becomes an expression of cultures, the games we play and how we play them. And I was chatting before he passed away with Mark McCormick, the founder of IMG, about one of his most amazing feats that he was most proud of. And he said, I put on and created the most widely viewed games in all of Asia. And I said, really? I said, what, a soccer match? He said, no, badminton. I said, badminton? He said, yes. He said, more people watched a badminton match we put on in India than any other televised sport. But for them, you can get really passionate about badminton, of all things. Who'd have guessed? And, you know, our English friends and their descendants around the globe, of course, they love cricket. I've watched cricket games in Australia and thought I was going to die of boredom. But they come and watch our baseball game and say the same thing. But they get incredibly passionate about it. I mean, just ridiculously so, just like we do at a Colts game or at a Pacers game or any other event here in town. And I guess the interesting thing for me also is that the United States was the only country out of all of our nations that combined sport in a very aggressive fashion with intercollegiate athletics. You go around the globe and you talk to university presidents, Charles and my colleagues from around the country, around the globe, and talk about your basketball team or your football team or your soccer team, and they look at you a little peculiarly because they don't have one of those. You bring a university president from abroad to the United States and take them to a football game or a basketball game, and they really, it's fascinating because they really just don't understand this dynamic. I have this wonderful memory of sitting in Tiger Stadium in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, with the president of the Sorbonne beside me, who remarkably doesn't speak much English, and having the chair of my French department interpret back and forth, trying to explain American football to a Frenchman on a Saturday night in Louisiana with 92,000 people, most of whom are drunk, and we're playing Tennessee, and it's one of these games that goes into overtime, and the fans are just going completely crazy. And he's loving it. He has no idea what he's watching, but he knows this is pretty amazing. And then, of course, everybody's shouting out, LSU, LSU. And he said, I want people to do that about the Sorbonne. You know, but it's kind of hard to imagine that occurring. But in the United States, that is an occurrence every Saturday all around our country. We have young people who participate in intercollegiate athletics as a normal course of their educational experience. And no one else does that. Nowhere in the world is that the case, despite the fact that everybody plays sports. Now, the upside and the downside of that, I think, are becoming pretty manifest. Indeed, they always have been. Intercollegiate athletics is 150 or so years old. It really got going. There were stabs at it just before the beginning of the Civil War. Started getting serious after the Civil War, pretty much all around the country simultaneously. Wherever there were colleges and universities, they started playing sports. The first competitions were rowing and baseball, and then it grew very rapidly, especially football, became identified almost uniquely with American higher education. And then at the turn of the 20th century, the beginning of the 20th century, turn of the 19th century, it was recognized that there were some very serious dark sides to all of this as well. The first real challenges, of course, were that young men were getting, because these were all young men at this point, were getting hurt and killed in very, very large numbers. In 1904, 19 boys died playing football in the United States. They were well under 10% of the number of people who play football today, probably 5 or 2% compared to today. So imagine, though, if 190 kids had died this past fall playing football, what the outrage of the nation would have been. And so Teddy Roosevelt and a handful of other people started saying, look, you've got to fix this or we'll fix it. They called together a group of university presidents, and in 1905 the NCAA was born because there was a notion that We weren't turning back the clock. We weren't going to stop playing sport. In fact, as early as 1905, it was unimaginable that we would say, nope, universities are not going to play sport. But there was a strong interest in trying to control it and regulate it and make it safe and make it more honorable and reduce the cheating. The cheating back in the pre-NCAA days was quite amazing. You can read these stories of how the games were won. It was quite fascinating. I'm really glad that I wasn't on the faculty back then because it was normal for the faculty to play. It was often assumed that the coach would play. And being a student at the institution was just, you know, a matter of choice. Not whether, you know, you didn't have to be enrolled in an institution to be on a team. That was just sort of an ancillary benefit if you happen to want to do it. And teams would routinely go down to the docks and find whoever they could, who looked the biggest and meanest, and hire them for that Saturday to come play football for their team. It was a regular affair. And then when you look at what we have today, and there are certainly things that we need to be concerned about, and there certainly are health and safety issues, and there's certainly regulatory issues that we need to worry about, the games today are incredibly safer and better regulated and better run than they ever were in the past. But if you go back and read in history of the 20th century, the complaints about intercollegiate athletics, you can take some of the letters written by university presidents, by sports media, by anyone, politicians, commentators, and if you just change the language to where it's 21st century instead of early 20th century, the concerns and the complaints are almost identical, despite the fact that a million things have changed during that time, and most of it for the betterment of the games, and most all of it for the betterment of the experience for our student athletes. And as you just heard, that's what I and the NCAA care about, is advancing the quality of that experience, the integration of intercollegiate athletes into this amazing cultural phenomenon of the American university in a way that serves all of our interests in higher education. That's the interesting rub for me as I talk to audiences about the NCAA and intercollegiate athletics. I'm often asked about what we really do and what we really care about, and it's always, quite understandably, from the perception of what that person cares about and knows about. And since this is an activity that stimulates enormous passion, especially for your home team or your alma mater, the questions or you know, whatever affiliation you might have with sport, the questions reflect all of that. And what I've been finding in my first 6 or 7 months is the mythology that has grown up around American intercollegiate athletics is quite fascinating because of the perspectives people might bring to sport. So I love to tell a story, for example, of my first month. I was out in Colorado Springs, and I'm meeting with the USOC leadership and the heads of the governing bodies of all of the individual sports around the country. And this guy afterwards, after I talked very angrily, was asking me why in the world universities accept international students. Because don't we understand we are training the enemy? Right? And he was a hockey guy. And he said, you know, those Canadians, they come down, they play hockey for American colleges, they go back and they're really good and they beat us. Don't you understand how bad this is? And from his point of view, a perfectly rational question, right? Because he's in the business of winning gold medals. We're in the business of educating kids and providing them with great experiences. So for all of the educators up here, having international students on your campus, in your classrooms, on your teams makes infinitely good sense. If your goal is to win gold medals for the United States, not so much, right? Same thing with fans. You know, the average fan, when they're out in the stands or they're reading the newspaper or they're sitting around the water cooler where their buddy from across the office around the corner is beating the tar out of him because his team just danced all over the other guy's team, he doesn't care about the rules of the game. He just knows my team lost. And that NCAA, they didn't let that kid play. And if they'd let him play, I wouldn't have to be listening to my friend over here give me a hard time. When I was at the University of Washington, I've been lucky enough to be around some really great teams and also some really bad teams. And when I was at the University of Washington, I guess it was my third year, we went 0-12 in football. And halfway through that season, my wife and I were down on the field doing something at halftime, and I'm walking back toward our seats. And Washington fans are actually very polite fans. They're passionate, but they're quite polite. I remember I was at LSU, so I know the difference. And we're walking back to our seats, and somebody in the stands yelled something very, very unkind in my direction. And my wife was quite indignant, and I said, honey, if I was in the stands, I'd be yelling at me. You know, we are 0-6. And so you understand that passion as well. And we, of course, want our student athletes to compete at the highest level. We want them to win But when we're running sport, the NCAA, the interesting thing about sport is there is a winner only by way of having a loser. You cannot possibly have everybody win, right? By definition, it's one of the things we like about it. There's a clear winner, there's a clear loser. We know that every day because in all of our sports, there's winners and there's losers. So we can't say for us in the NCAA, our goal is to have everybody win. Our goal is to have as much competitive equity as we can create. Our goal is to have the games conducted in a way that everyone has as fair a chance to win that game as possible. Our goal is to make sure that the student athletes have a really quality experience and can compete and exhibit and develop their skills to the very highest level possible. But our goal really isn't to make sure that Alabama wins the next national championship. But my friends in Alabama believe that that should be my goal as head of the NCAA. That's not our business either. When you talk to colleagues who are in the media, especially those who promote and put on our games, they believe that our business is to help them make money. And indeed for them in turn to help us have resources to support athletics. And that's obviously a significant part of what goes on today. So we have very, very large budgets. I mean, they look huge relative to what they were not really very long ago. The NCAA this last spring with Jim Ish and Greg, where's Jim? With Jim Ish and Greg Shaheen leading the charge did a $10.8 billion contract to broadcast men's basketball for the next 14 years. At the time, the largest, I think maybe still, the largest media contract in the history of athletics with CBS Turner. Great, great contract, wonderful thing. And when you see those numbers, a lot of people come away from that thinking, well, that's business of intercollegiate sport. It's all about money. That's all that's about. It's money. The BCS is all about money, and the new contract for the Big Ten Network is all about money. And the fact of the matter is money is not trivial. Money is very consequential to being able to provide the opportunities that student athletes want to have. And we love having great commercial partners that provide resources that we can move on to all of our institutions and provide them with support and opportunity. So this year, across the United States, there will be a total, last year anyway, probably will be the same or worse this year, there was a grand total of 14 universities. Out of the 1,100 NCAA members, 14 Division I universities that had positive cash flow playing sport. 14. There are very, very few universities that can take money out of all of that cash that flows through all those stadiums, that can take money out of sports and give it to the academic side. In most cases, virtually all cases, the university, through state resources or student fees or tuition revenue or a variety of other sources, supports sports, not the other way around. It is not a money-making proposition for any institution save for those 14 that we can almost literally count on our fingers, right? Well, if you had six fingers, you could almost count them. But you can count them on your digits. And so the idea that this is all about making money doesn't make any sense at all. I promise you, IUPUI and Indiana State don't play sports because they're making buckets of money. They play sports because they want to provide opportunity for their student athletes, and that's what happens out of the NCAA, because that flow of resources from institutions, from the media, from ticket sales, this year will provide $2 billion, that's with a B, $2 billion in scholarship support for 400,000 student athletes. That's the second largest source of scholarship money behind the federal government for people to go to college and have opportunities to go to college. 400,000 young men and women get to play those games, and a huge portion of those get direct scholarship support, and all of them get indirect support for their work as student athletes as well as students. So the business isn't about making money. It is terrific that a small portion of our sports, mostly football and men's basketball, are incredibly entertaining, and that we all enjoy going to them, and we are willing to pay for the privilege and the opportunity to go watch a great game. and that people watch it on TV, and therefore people are willing to support television. But that's not our business. Our business is, back to the beginning of my introduction, it's about providing young people with great opportunities to develop as people, to become great students, and to fulfill their potential and their aspirations in athletics to the best of their ability. Doesn't matter whether it's a Division III school where they're doing it without scholarship support and mostly for fun and engagement, or whether they're doing it at the Final Four. The process is virtually the same. The attention that it gets changes pretty radically, but the process doesn't. And the success ratio that we're having in all of that is really quite amazing. There are not enough people that understand that student-athletes are actually significantly better students than the non-athletes are. The graduation rates across Division I and II for all of our sports are higher than they are for the non-athletes. Student-athletes do extremely well. When we go back and survey our student-athletes to make sure that how they're doing 10 years out, it turns out that 88%, almost 90% of them, have finished their bachelor's degree, 90%. There are very few cohorts in America that you could identify that 90% have finished their bachelor's degree. A third of them have master's degrees at that stage of their career. They're being wonderfully successful. And as our ads say, very, very few of them go pro. They all go pro, basically, in something other than sports. Less than 2% of those 5,500 kids who play Division I basketball will ever play professional basketball. A smaller proportion than that will ever make it to the NBA. The vast majority of them simply had their lives changed and opportunities provided for them because they said, I want to play collegiate ball. And they got a chance to do it. That's what our business is. All those other things, that's fun, it's exciting, we like it, they're useful, but it's not our core business. Our core business is the education business. I often say when I'm asked, well, you left the University of Washington, why did you leave higher education? I most certainly did not leave higher education. I just moved into a different part of it because that's what we do at the NCAA. So I'm delighted to bring you that those words. I think we have time for questions. I hope we do. Yes? I'd be happy to answer questions about any of those things or anything else that's on your mind. Well,
yep, questions,
within
so
reason.
Send them up.
Yeah, great, great business question. So the question is, you know, we've got a 14-year contract. It's media-based, and obviously media, I'm paraphrasing, please forgive me, the media delivery mechanisms are changing rapidly. There is a lot of transformation of all those marketplaces. How do you make sure that you're in the right place at the right time as that market changes? Well, part of that is you have to be really agile. Part of it is you have to have partners that you know are trying to stay on top of that game, too. With Turner and CBS, we got two great partners that are doing, especially on the Turner side, they're doing wonderful stuff on all the digital platforms, and they're staying at the front of that game. And then CBS is a more traditional broadcast partner, but they do it as well as anybody does it, and they're trying to figure out where all of those moving targets go as well. One of the appeals right now for sport in the marketplace, in the media marketplace, is that all of the broadcasters and all of the cable outlets are deeply concerned about our viewing habits. So we all, or not all of us, many of us are now watching the kinds of things we watch on TV in an asynchronous fashion. We watch it when we want to watch it. We don't have to wait for it to come at Thursday at 7 o'clock. We can, you know, if we don't TiVo it, we've got it on our Hulu or some other process, and it's all being converted to streaming content across the Internet. One of the nice things about sport is everybody wants it live. Right? It's a social experience. You want to have, think about how you watch a Super Bowl. If you're not in the stands, you want friends at your house so you can experience it together live. You want to be able to text your buddy about the fact that your team's crushing their team. You want to, right? It's as much a social experience. You don't quite do that so much when you're watching, you know, Grey's Anatomy. I'm not picking on Grey's Anatomy, but it's a different kind of viewing experience. So you can watch it whenever you want to watch it, but with a basketball game, you got to say, "Don't tell me this outcome. I don't want to. You know, I don't want to know." It's something that synchronicity works in. You want to be there. You want to experience it. All the broadcast outlets understand that, so that makes it a pretty powerful bit of inventory for them.
Athletes and coaches
are held accountable for their deviation from NCAA policy. Will we ever see a time when agents and boosters are punished for their violations?
Well, we're trying very hard. The encroachment of agents and third parties, as they're loosely described, is first of all, it's not anything all that new at all. It's been around for a long time, but it's become more aggressive in recent years, at least in part because of the larger amount of money that professional athletes can make, because of a variety of things that have occurred in the whole context of sport. We find ourselves in a challenging position relative to third parties because we are not in legal terms, a state actor. We are a voluntary association. So we don't have the ability to compel someone to do anything unless they're a member of the NCAA. So we can, if we want to, for example, on the enforcement side, it's the best place to understand this. On the enforcement side, if we think someone has done something wrong, we can compel a student athlete or a coach or an administrator or even a booster to talk to us. We can't do that with somebody who's not under the umbrella of the NCAA. So if a former athlete who's left school doesn't want to talk to us, they can just say, I know, I'm not talking to you. If it's somebody over here on the side who's an agent who doesn't have any affiliation with us, he just says, I'm not talking to you. Why would I talk to you? We don't have subpoena power like a governmental entity. Everything has to be done. We have to do a lot of that work a lot more like an investigative reporter does than an attorney general does. And we have some of the same challenges then with trying to regulate agents. We can control what happens on our campuses, around our student athletes, the contact student athletes might have, but when they get outside that domain of what we have direct control over, it's very, very hard. So we have started on the football side, for example, to work with all of the parties, the agents themselves, because there's a lot of good agents out there who do very important work, the NFL folks, NFL Players Association, our coaches, our players, all of our folks internally, state attorneys general who try to regulate these things. And so for the first time, we've got all the right players at the table, and I'm optimistic that we're going to come up with some new models for regulating it. Right now, the regulatory environment for agents is controlled in the NBA and the NFL, by the players' associations, by the players, I guess we can't call the NFL PA a players' union anymore because they disbanded, but pretend they're still a union, the players' unions, and that's who agents get certified with. So we're going to try and work with all of them to get a much better handle on it. It is a very complicated problem, but we're trying very hard.
Thank you. What are your thoughts about paying student athletes?
Well, you can't, because if you did, they wouldn't be student athletes anymore. They'd be professional athletes. And if we wanted professional athletes, then we should just have IUPUI subcontract with the Indians and have them change their jerseys, and they could be their baseball team. And I say that only slightly glibly. I feel very, very strongly that the notion of paying collegiate athletes is an utterly wrong-headed idea. Now, that's very different from making sure that we're supporting them in all the right ways. But let's kind of walk down that road for a minute. If we said we were going to pay student athletes, what are you going to pay them? I mean, how much? You pay them all the same, whether they're on the football team or the women's gymnastic team? And if you're going to pay the football team, do you pay the quarterback the same as you pay the guy who's sitting on the bench, whoever gets on the field? And how are you going to decide on that? Are you going to negotiate with them? And well, if they're going to be employees, then of course they'd have a right to unionize. Why wouldn't they? And then what are we going to do when we're unhappy with them? Lock them out of the campus? I mean, that whole notion is on the face of it, completely and utterly inconsistent with what makes intercollegiate athletics special and distinctive, that these are students. They are not professional athletes. They are part of our institutions. We loved watching Butler play in the Final Four because they were Butler students, not a team that Butler had gone down and hired somewhere. They were members of that campus community. And that's a fundamental precept behind all of intercollegiate athletics, and we're going to We're going to cling to that to the bitter end.
Okay. Title IX was great for girls and young women, but has been devastating for boys. What can be done without hurting the advances made in women's sports?
Well, I guess I would disagree with the premise that it's been devastating for boys. It's certainly been remarkable for women. I remember, you know, from my age, for us baby boomers, when we were in high school even, the opportunities for girls to play sports were trivial. I mean, there's very, very few of them in almost every school. Indeed, at most universities, you didn't really have many collegiate athletic opportunities for women well into the 70s and 80s in a lot of places. Title IX has had a profound impact. As the questioner points out, it's had a profound and positive impact on athletic opportunities and many other opportunities, but especially athletic opportunities. So I have always been and will remain a staunch defender of Title IX. In fact, I described it once as the Magna Carta of women's athletics, because I think that's true. The fact that we've had to find balance between sports and our affordability and the financial sustainability of sports is a big challenge for us right now, I think, is regrettable. So we have seen sports go away because there wasn't enough money to support all of the sports that we wanted to have in place. But I think the overall benefit of Title IX vastly exceeds the complexities that it's added.
What is the role of the Big Ten Network versus the NCAA's role?
Well, there's no way competitiveness in those roles at all. I'm really delighted with what I'm seeing around the rise of some of these new modes of getting intercollegiate athletics out on the airways. It's a reflection, of course, of what you were asking, Mark, around the division of and the amplification of the number of channels and outlets and distribution channels that are available. And so if you watch the Big Ten Network, you see things that you would never see before on TV. Now you see, back to women's athletics, you see many, many more women's athletics competitions on TV than you would have before. You see some non-athletic broadcasting on there. You know, they're talking about a Pac-10 channel out on the Pac-12, I guess now, channel out on the West Coast where I was, and one of the first questions that came up was, okay, how much time are we going to be able to dedicate to non-athletic programming so we can do other things that are of interest to those audiences, and how do we broadcast women's volleyball and gymnastics? And so I think that those two developments are very, very mutually reinforcing. They provide much greater access for many more people to a lot of really cool and interesting sports and competitions, and that's great for the competitors, and it's great for developing collegiate sport.
And as we had some conversation over lunch about the BCS, and here's a question. Clarify this for us. That might be the best way to put this.
Clarify the BCS. Well, you kind of have to go back, as my history lesson began, you know, back in the beginnings of the 20th century when we started these interesting community things called bowl games, right? Remember, we just had a handful of them when most of us were growing up. You could watch almost all of them on New Year's Day. And they started broadcasting them in the 50s, I guess. They first went on TV. And so we've had, parallel to the development of the NCAA and all of our NCAA championships, we've had these bowl games developing off to the side, which were combined sort of like the 500. They're combined with community festivals and all the things that go along with them. So they took on a life of their own. In all the other sports that we oversee, we run the, I think that's, yeah, literally the case, we run the championships. So we run 88 national championships out of the NCAA. The only one in all of collegiate athletics that we don't run is the BCS, the FBS division of Division I football, the Football Bowl subdivision, used to call it old 1A. And that's just a historical artifact. It has always been that the end of the season in American football was you went to a bowl game or your season was over. And then along comes a group of commissioners mostly. Roy Kramer out of the SEC was sort of the godfather of the BCS. And the idea was, let's try and create something that produces something that looks more like a champion. Let's take the six dominant athletic conferences and let's have them play each other, and we got a higher probability of getting numbers one and two playing each other. And then they modified it about halfway through that process. They modified it, added a fifth game, and said, okay, in that fifth game, we'll have numbers one and two play each other, and then we'll really finally have a champion. But, of course, that's not as satisfactory as people would like, because they see the format, for example, of our basketball tournaments, men's and women's tournaments, and they say, gee, that's what a playoff really looks like. But the reality is that the vast majority of FBS football bowl subdivision universities like the bowl model. The students like the bowl model. We had 70 schools go to bowl games last year. Every one of those schools liked going to a bowl game. It was fun. It's exciting. Kids like the chance to go play in bowls. It's, you know, it's a rewarding way to end your season. And the membership has not said to us, the NCAA, and we serve that membership. Remember, we're a voluntary association. Our job is to serve the interests and needs of that membership. And that membership has not yet said, we would like to have a playoff of some kind. Should they do that, my position has been, we know how to run championships. We stand ready to serve you. And we're more than happy to do that. If that's where the FBS schools want to go, the BCS is a collection of the 11 conferences that play FBS football. They govern themselves. They play all the games are all played under our rules. We license the bowl games, but they run the BCS process of selecting teams and seeding those teams, not us. So I think it's going to be interesting to watch that all play out in the coming years, but our job is to support what the members want.
And this question is, what will be the impact of the richer conferences getting additional resources from the Big Ten, SEC, Pac-10 networks?
Well, the outcome is going to be a continued widening of the gap between schools that are in those conferences and those that aren't. If you look at Division I athletics, now bear in mind that when we talk about Division I and those big six conferences, we're talking about a small subsection of all of intercollegiate athletics. But when you look at Division I, you've got schools with Division I budgets of $5 million for all of their athletic department, and some with $125 million for all their athletic department. So there's a huge, huge gap. And the schools that are in conferences that are part of these big media combines and who have access to larger revenues predominantly around football, they are somewhat ironically the ones that are most likely to be self-supporting. So at $125 million, Ohio State's budget is not a drain at all on the budget of the Ohio State University, right? In fact, they send money back to the university. At $5 million, with a much, much smaller budget, that a significant portion, maybe nearly all of that budget, is having to come from other university sources, so it's having to be subsidized. So in an odd twist, having a big budget and being part of a big program is actually less of a drain on a university than having a medium-sized or a smaller-sized budget because you don't have those revenue opportunities. So we don't have control over the media and how they value those things. Those are going to be media decisions. If Ohio State wants to make their stadium $200,000, they can do it. That's not our business. And then they'll have even more football revenue, I suppose. So as the market provides them with those kind of opportunities, I suspect what we'll see is a widening of the gap in the size of those budgets. Now, what we do is we set constraints on how the games are played, the number of students who get scholarships, what a scholarship is defined as, the rules of the game on the field, the rules for recruiting. So we provide as much comparability of those processes as we possibly can. But I'd be shocked if we didn't see a continued widening of some of those gaps, just as we see it in a variety of other things around universities.
Mark Emmert, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Mark Emmert, the new president of the Indianapolis-based NCAA. The monthly economic club meetings will be on summer recess, resuming this fall with a new roster of speakers. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sharon Allseth.
Proliance Energy, providing natural gas to more than 1,200 commercial, industrial, utility, and municipal customers. Proliance, adding power to energy. Information is at proliance.com.